In the first hour today, we'll be talking with James Cuno. He is the president and Eloise W. Martin director of the Art Institute of Chicago, by any measure, one of the most important and largest art museums in the United States. Just for example, back in 2005, the museum attracted more than 1.4 million visitors, placing it fourth among major museums in this country after the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the National Gallery, and the Museum of Modern Art in New York. They have 85,000 members, more than 85,000. Only one other, the Met in New York, has more. We'll be talking this morning about some of the challenges faced by directors of major institutions like this, and certainly they are considerable as they try to satisfy the mission of the museum, its educational and documentary mission, while at the same time keeping the institution financially strong. Just a little bit of background about our guest. He has taught at a number of institutions, including Harvard, Dartmouth, UCLA, and Vassar. Before taking his job at Chicago, he was the director of the Courtauld Institute of Art at the University of London, also has been director of the Harvard University Art Museums, the Hood Museum of Art at Dartmouth. He holds a master's degree in history of art from University of Oregon and PhD in fine arts from Harvard University. And we're pleased that he could be spending some time with us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions certainly are welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. So at any point here, if you'd like to participate in the conversation, you would certainly be welcome to do that. Dr. Cuno, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. Well,
thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. You know, one of the things that started us thinking about this subject and looking for someone to talk about just what was involved in being a museum director was an article that appeared in the New York Times last summer, noting, among other things, that there were a number of major institutions in this country that were looking for new directors, 24 of them at the time. And in this particular article, it quotes the executive director of the Association of Art Museum Directors, Mimi Gaudieri, surname, saying that she didn't remember there being this many openings since perhaps the mid-1980s. And I'm sure that there are a number of reasons, but one of those that's cited by the article is, in fact, that it's a tough job. Would you say that today it is more difficult to be the director of a large museum than it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago?
You know, I think it's very hard to say. We like to say that it is because it makes us feel good when we think about the jobs we're doing, I think. But probably if you asked the same question 20 years ago, 20, 30 years ago, directors then would also say that it was more difficult than it was or had been 20 or 30 years before then. So it's a little hard to disengage from the current conditions of the job. It's clear the job has been changing over time, and it's been changing as museums have gotten larger and more complex in their operations, and so the responsibilities of the director are larger and more complex than they once were. So in that sense, it's at least a more complex job. I don't know that it's any more difficult than it was, but it certainly requires probably different kinds of concentrations than it did before.
Well, that points to an issue that I think probably people talk about in the field, and that is if you take a look at the background of people who manage these kinds of institutions, what it has been and perhaps what it might be, it would seem that in the past, more of the people that were directing large museums had the kind of educational background that you do, for example. Their background was in art history. And now we see perhaps more people coming into the field whose background is not art history, but it's art management. And that is that they are more perhaps MBAs than they are art scholars. Now that may be an unfair characterization of the field, but it does suggest that the development side of things, particularly the side that involves marketing and fundraising, has become very important. Has that become more important than the other side?
I would put it more like this, and that is that the job, if the way we think about the museum director's job in the past is in fact as it was. That is, it were accurate the way we think about it. In the past, one associated the museum director with sort of the primary curatorial thrust of the institution. That is, that it was he mainly, sometimes she, but for the most part he, who was identified with the major acquisitions. You said of Museum Cleveland, for example. You'd say Sherman Lee acquired that, and that Sherman Lee, you might have said that about not only the works of Chinese art, for which he was a renowned expert, but works of art in, you know, the cultures of Egypt or Europe or the United States. So we gave him credit. We give him credit for that now. We say that he, as director, acquired this. He built that collection. He did that. Now, I don't think we'd say that today, because I think today the curatorial staff of a museum is of greater importance than it was previously, and has greater autonomy than it did previously, partly as a result of the growth in academic training for art historians over the years. I mean, it's a bigger enterprise in the academy than it was 50 and 60 years ago. So there are more students in higher education, in art history, seeking employment in museums, and we are asking of them to conceive of, organize, execute ever-increasingly important, larger, more scholarly exhibitions, and we're asking them to build these collections, which are the lasting legacy we leave behind. So the curatorial staff, I think, is much, much more important. It would be impossible and inappropriate today to say of any museum director, he or she acquired that, built that collection. The museum director now encourages curatorial staff to do the work they do, finds the means to help them do the work they do, but it isn't the same relationship that it was once in the past where the director sort of towers over and takes charge of the curatorial thrust of the institution. The museum director today is running a big enterprise, and that big enterprise has, in that sense, he or she's got responsibility for all aspects of it, from the curatorial to the operational to the legal to the marketing and development side of things. And so I think the museum director's job is to make sure that the museum itself is stronger than it was when he or she arrived, that it's moving the entire institution forward as simultaneously a repository of fragile, important things that we wish to keep in the public domain forever, and an important part, a vitally important part of the community.
Well, there was an article, another article, actually, that this also was in the New York Times, perhaps about a year ago, that mentioned you specifically, this was after you had already been there in Chicago for a couple of years, in which you talked about the fact that you would like to perhaps emphasize some different things or take the museum in a slightly different direction, which invites this question, as director, how much authority do you have? Can you, in fact, say, here at the Art Institute, we're going to go in this direction. We're going to place more emphasis on, for example, I think in this, you said you wanted to place more emphasis on either modern art or 20th century art, something to that effect. So can you say that we're going to emphasize modern American painting, or you could say what we're really going to emphasize is East Asian art or non-Western art or whatever. How much, as director, how much influence do you really have in setting the direction for the museum?
Well, ultimately, the director has the final authority on deciding the calendar of exhibitions, or in fact, the acquisition. The final authority for acquisitions is the Board of Trustees, but I mean final authority taking the object, the acquisition, to the Board of Trustees for final approval. It must go through the director's office, and so the director can say yes or no. However, you know, any good leader of an organization isn't a dictator. And so the job of the director, if the director wants to take the museum in a certain direction curatorially with regard to exhibitions or acquisitions or publications or lectures or educational programs, whatever, is to build consensus around that direction. So it's encouraging the curatorial staff to see that this is, in fact, the direction the museum ought to take. it ought to take for the reasons that it's in keeping with the interests of a public. It's complements the current profile of the museum in the community. It represents well the diversity of the collections of the museum. It's in fact, increasingly important that we introduce our community to the diversity of the world's cultures. All kinds of reasons one can marshal to take a museum in a certain direction, but one has to lead the museum in that direction. One can't dictate that the museum go in that direction. So it's like running any large organization. You lead by example, and you've got some authority, and that authority is approval and budgetary to help you in the process, but you've got to bring people along with you.
Is it possible to say, roughly speaking, how much of your time is occupied with, on the one hand, thinking about and acting on the matter of what's on the walls and what kind of programs that you're doing and so forth, things that really relate very directly to the content, to the collections, to the exhibitions, and how much time you spend doing things like marketing and fundraising?
Yeah, I find that the two things are kind of seamlessly linked, if that doesn't sound like a contradiction in terms. But I mean that the fundraising that we do, the marketing that we do, we market in order to encourage people to engage with the museum, that we want the museum to be a vitally important part of their lives. And so we want them to conceive of a relationship with the museum in a certain kind of way, and so we market to that fact. We don't market to sell toothpaste. We don't market to sell tickets. We market to shape the perception about the importance of the museum in the lives of our community, and part of that is seamlessly together with that is we've got to get the resources to make that true, to deliver the goods, to make it the case that the museum is in fact vitally important, is responsive to, does bring value to their lives, and that takes money. We don't make money, we are a charity. We depend on the donations of others and the investment of others in our enterprise who believe in what we do, that who believe that what we do is in fact good and returns value to their lives. So we've got to be out telling that story, convincing people to join with us in this relationship, and fundraising and marketing is a critical part of that. And when we bring them here for that and we get their involvement and get their investment, get their support, it is on the terms of what we alone can offer them, and that is access to works of art, and not just access, but to informed access of works of art as presented on the walls in our permanent collection or in special exhibitions. So those three things, to me, are just all part of the same enterprise. It's about moving the museum forward in the lives of our community, the people in our community, and secondly, to make sure, in addition to that, that we are providing a safe harbor for these fragile things we call works of art, which we determine to be of such value that we want to bring them into the public domain for all of time. And it takes money to do that, and the museum director's job is to be sure that we do that well and we have the resources to do it well.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is James Cuno. He's the president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago, has been since September of 2004. And we're talking about some of the practical concerns that someone like him faces as the director of a major art museum. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think that it is the case that certainly, and this is not a new concern, that arts organizations, being nonprofits, depend certainly on contributions from individuals, but they also do depend to some extent on public money, although that seems for some time now to have been declining. For the Art Institute, what's the breakdown of your funding when you look at public and private monies?
Well, we get only about 9 or 8% government funding, direct government funding. So public monies for the museum on a budget of, let's say, $70 million, we'll get about $6 million through the Museums in the Park in Chicago. So in the direct sense, it's a small, very small number. It's a vitally important number. But, you know, the bigger question, or the greater way that the government supports not-for-profits like museums, is for by indirectly, by providing incentives for people to give privately, to invest in the museum. And that is, of course, you know, the sort of deferred revenue by way of tax advantages. So the government is a part of everything we do. What they've done is said, okay, we will defer the revenue we might get by taking taxes away from the citizens, and instead we'll encourage the citizens to give that money directly to this enterprise. Let's say it's the museum as opposed to a hospital or something like that. So in some senses, there's direct allocation of funds from the government, in our case, about 9% of our budget, leaving 91% of the budget for us to raise, most of which we raise through donation by far, maybe 10 or 20% at most do we raise by earned revenue from our auxiliary services like restaurant and shop. But I would say 70% comes easily through donation or from endowment, which is a result of prior donations. But the government helps us in this in every step, and I think that's something that we lose track of when we talk about comparing ourselves to Europeans, for example, or Japanese or Chinese museums, and say that we don't get government support. Well, we do get government support, but in a very, very important way, and that is that they encourage the museum and the citizens to come together in a joint effort to advance the state of art museums in this country. And it gives us, I think, a relationship to our community that our European colleagues don't have. When they benefit, and they're benefiting less and less, I guess, in their terms, from direct subsidy, government subsidy, they don't have a sense, really, of who their constituency is, what it comprises, and a direct relationship with them. They're not engaged in a conversation with their constituency the way that we are. We're constantly talking with them in one way or another, and we have that relationship. We know who they are, and it's a very much better and a much more dynamic relationship. And the government facilitates that by offering the tax incentives they do.
The mission, obviously, of the museum is to get people to come in and stand in front, at least to begin with, to stand in front of the art. You got to get people in the door. And I think that for some time now, it has been one of the major ways the museums have done that is to mount or to participate in big, sometimes international touring exhibitions, the blockbuster. And I know this is something that you have strong feelings about. I certainly at least have read your comments about that, saying that in fact that you've been very critical of these kinds of exhibitions. I'm sure that other people in other museums have said, well, they help bring people in and they get people to be members, but you seem to be questioning whether, in fact, that kind of thing, if you get people to come to the museum once a year or a couple of times a year for a big show, whether, in fact, that gets people to develop a long-term commitment to the museum and perhaps then also to contribute to, you know, whatever level they can, that these kinds of big shows perhaps don't do that. Am I correctly representing your feelings about these things?
Yeah, I think in most respects you are. I mean, I think what we want to do in museums is to change people's lives. We've been given this great responsibility to preserve these things, again, these very fragile things, that we feel and that people seem to agree with us are very important to be kept for all of time. We've got things that are 5,000 years old. We've got things that will be 5,000 years from now, 5,000 years old. And that's a kind of extraordinary responsibility, it seems to me, that's a responsibility that's humbling to each and every one of us. And that relationship, the trust that the public has in us is to build that collection for them and to make this experience meaningful to them, to change their lives. That comes in a number of ways. I think that it comes in a most lasting way by frequent engagements with works of art, that it's repeat visits to the museum, and not just to the museum, but to things, particular things in the museum, that the museum just isn't a a rentable space, as it were, for temporary exhibitions to come through, to disappear, not to be seen again for decades or in the life of a particular individual. But the kind of relationship, there's something that's so almost unique, I think, about the Art Institute of Chicago, very special indeed about the Art Institute of Chicago, is the sense of regard the public has for this museum as their museum. And that's a regard that's built over a lifetime of coming to this museum, of identifying with particular works of art in the museum, of sharing an individual's delight in those particular works of art with multiple generations in their family over the course of time. And temporary exhibitions don't do that. I mean, we do temporary exhibitions for three reasons, I guess. One reason is because it advances the scholarly work of our curators. Second, it emphasizes our permanent collection. It derives from our permanent collection objects in our collections that require that they be put in the context of other works of art that aren't here, that we bring here for that reason, to complement our permanent collection, or because we don't have those things here and we think our public needs to see those things. For example, this summer we are doing a major exhibition that by any measure is a blockbuster in the sense of scale of exhibition that we've done together with colleagues in Vienna and Berlin and Paris on the distinguished West African culture of the Kingdom of Benin. And we've got four objects from that kingdom, the kingdom that really was thriving most from the 14th century to the 19th century. And it represents an achievement of human creativity of great distinction, and it represents the achievement of that continent, the great diverse continent of Africa, that needs to be more appreciated. And here in Chicago, with the people who, living in Chicago, who are interested in and need to know more about the world beyond these borders, but also because we have a great West African community in Chicago, it's incredibly important to bring that exhibition here. It's not going to be blockbuster in the sense of great numbers of people coming in and revenue deriving from great numbers of tickets sold. That's not the reason we do exhibitions. We want great numbers of people to come in because we're in the business of bringing people together with works of art. But we don't devise exhibitions for that reason. In other words, we don't devise exhibitions to affirm people's already proven interest in something, to show them something they know they already like. We devise exhibitions to introduce them to things we think they will like and will be curious about, and in fact might ought to be curious about. And so we want to broaden and enrich their lives, and exhibitions help us do that. But at the end of the day, it is that lifelong relationship with a museum and its permanent collection that really changes people's lives. Hmm.
Certainly, I think that you would say that the fact that the museum has a very significant member base, and that in fact only one other museum in the United States has more, and that's the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, shows that you're certainly doing something right. At the same time, there has been, I think, a fairly, say between roughly speaking 2001 and 2005 or 2006, a fairly significant decline in membership at the Art Institute. And I suppose one could explain that again in a number of ways, including the fact that there's a lot of competition for people's money and time and attention. And that I'm sure that that's something that you have thought about and that you're concerned about. How do you think about that, particularly if there has indeed been a decline? Why? And then what sort of things are you doing, anything directly to try to turn that around?
Yeah, it is an interesting, very, very interesting phenomenon, I think. And the first thing I would say about this extraordinarily high membership base that we have, I used to think that was the achievement of my great friend and immediate predecessor, Jim Wood, and thinking, gosh, over the 24 years he was here, he did this extraordinary thing, because, look, there's 100,000 people in the membership, you know, as an indication of an achievement of the museum and its director. I got here and realized Jim did an extraordinary job here for 24 years, certainly, but that evidence is evidence not of the success of this museum, but of the character of the city of Chicago. It is about people here who participate in the lives of their cultural institutions, whether it's the local theater or the lyric opera or the symphony or the museum. It is in the nature of civic life in Chicago. Now, that said, we have seen membership declining over the years, and that tells me that, those membership numbers were artificially inflated. They were inflated by a sense that membership offered you something. It was a transactional relationship. That is, that you got something immediately for that membership, and that happened to coincide with very popular exhibitions that were difficult to get into, for which there were long lines, and membership got you in on certain days, certain times, ahead of the line, and that kind of thing. So the transaction is, I give you money for membership, and you get me into the museum, and I avoid, you know, the complications of long lines. Over the course of since 1990, I suppose, so let's say the course of the last 15 years, in any case, we've seen the numbers of attendance and ticketed exhibitions decline continuously and dramatically, from 900,000 famously, who came, almost a million, who came to see the Monet exhibition about 12 years ago or so, until now maybe 150,000 to see the Vollard exhibition of these extraordinary pictures from Cézanne to Picasso that included these great Degas, great Van Goghs, great Gauguins. And in between, there was Seurat, and there was Renoir, and there was Van Gogh, Gauguin, and there was Manet in the Sea, and Toulouse-Lautrec. In other words, over the course of that decade or so, there were six major exhibitions by Parisian-based artists working over only a three-decade period. So it wasn't that these were a diverse range of exhibitions of artists with which people were not very familiar. They were very familiar with them. They liked them very much. We find those galleries, our permanent collections, often most occupied, so that people are in there looking at these works of art all the time. And yet we saw the popularity of these exhibitions declining dramatically. Interestingly, while they declined in attendance, the general attendance to the museum, the overall attendance to the museum, stayed the same. So clearly, roughly 1.3 to 1.5 million people were coming, but they were dropping off and going to the ticketed exhibitions from 900,000 to 150,000. So clearly, over the course of that time, fewer and fewer people who were coming to the museum in the same numbers were then spending a little bit more money to go into the special exhibition. They were spending their time in the permanent collection. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is to convince people to think about membership not in terms of this transactional relationship that gets them ahead of a queue, but rather think of it as their involvement in, their commitment to, their participation in the life of the museum. So it's much more about membership. It's not about a retail activity. It's really about supporting this institution as important to them and to the life of their city.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is James Cuno. He is the president and Eloise W. Martin director of the Art Institute of Chicago and has been since September of 2004. Before that, he served as director of the Courtauld Institute of Art at the University of London. Before that, was director of the Harvard University Art Museum and Museums and professor of the history of art and architecture there at Harvard. And before that, was director of the Hood Museum of Art and adjunct professor of art history at Dartmouth. Is also taught at UCLA and at Vassar. And we're talking about what's involved in being the director of a large art museum. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And we are a little bit past our midpoint here. I think that for some time now, when it comes to media, one of the big buzzwords has been interactivity. And I wonder if it's possible to apply that to the museum experience and whether you think that it is, in a sense, enough to get people to come into the door and to stand in front of paintings, or whether somehow you have to find other ways to engage them and involve them with art that can be more active than that.
I think it's a very delicate balance. That is that we know that people want to come to see things in the museum, to engage with them, to look closely at them. We know that we can help them in that by suggesting ways of looking and ways of thinking about what one sees, and we do that in various ways. We do that by labels on the wall, by audio guides, by iPod broadcasts, by websites that help them prepare for their visit or that allow them to think about their visit once they've returned home. We do that by docents. We do that by lectures in the auditorium. All kinds of ways that we do provide this, again, informed access to works of art in our collection. However, we have to be very careful not to intervene between the experience of the visitor and the work of art. That is, not to have that experience be about us. It's got to be about that work of art. And we can't presume that we know what they're interested in, what questions they might be asking, what they need to know. We want them to be able to, from that experience, begin to ask questions which we can help them answer. So it's a delicate thing. It's like any teacher in a classroom. It is the subject that is important. It's not the teacher that is important. The teacher is a means to that subject. It's a facilitator in the experience. So it's a delicate matter. But I think you're absolutely right. More and more people want to engage and make this a dynamic experience and not a passive experience. It's often a social experience. It's often people talking to each other among each other about what they're seeing. We probably have all had that experience ourselves, that we see more discriminately, we think more acutely when we have to articulate in words what it is that we see or think about something. And that often happens just in pairs of people walking around together, but sometimes it happens in the company of a museum docent.
We have a caller here. In fact, we have a couple. We'll bring them into the conversation. First is in the community of Belgium, not the country, but the nearby community here downstate, and this is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I got a couple of questions along financial situations for museums. If you go to many museums, the British Museum, most museums in Washington, D.C., they're all free. Obviously, they're supported by a nation, not by individuals, and I can understand why they're free. But also, you go to many of these other museums. You go to the Indianapolis Art Museum, even your museum. They've been founded by people who are very wealthy and gave a great deal of money, and some of them were forward-thinking enough to say that, you know, I don't think we need to charge to let the common man into this to see some of these things. But yet other ones charge. I mean, and as a matter of fact, the Art Institute charges, but it's a little-known fact that you can go in for free or whatever donation you want. Now, it seems that you would get a lot more participation if more people knew that. You know what I mean? You don't say that on the sign any place, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I agree with you that one respect, free admission is a great aid. And it's an aid not only because it allows people to come in who can't, let's say, easily otherwise afford to come in, but it makes them come in frequently or casually. Let's say that you've got only an hour or a half an hour. You've got a lunch break. You're working downtown. Or you're coming in from out of town and you've got some appointment, but you have a half an hour and you just want to go see the Grand Jatte because you love the picture and you haven't seen it in a long time. You'll just dash in. If you have to pay $15 to come in, you're going to feel like, I can't afford $15 for a half an hour experience. Or if I'm going to pay $15, I better give up 3.5 hours to this, and that you're going to be exhausted at the end of the 3.5 hours, and it's not going to be necessarily a pleasurable experience. So I agree with you that since, as I've been trying to say in this interview, that we want the work, the experience of the museum to change people's lives, we want them to feel a part of it and come in often and as they wish for as long as they wish. And the admission fee can be an impediment. However, the way economics works, to keep a $70 million operation running, you've got to get some revenue coming in. And that revenue comes in various ways. In one way, it comes in a minority way, of course, but nevertheless an important way is by way of admission. So what we try to do is to offer an opportunity for people to avoid paying that admission. We do now, however, and have for the last couple of years, required an admission. It used to be a suggested admission, as you say. It is now a $12 required fee, so you do have to pay that. However, we are free all the month of February, free every Thursday during the winter, free every Thursday and Friday, I mean during the year, every Thursday and Friday during the summer, free for children under 12, and for, you know, a membership of $75, free for families. So it's a and free for all school teachers in the state of Illinois, and free for students who come in. So, you know, it's, there are plenty of ways to get around paying, but we do need to get that certain amount of revenue in to contribute to the revenue that we need to balance the budget on the on a big, complicated $70 million enterprise like this.
Yeah, I understand. And the other thing, if I might bring up, I've gone to the Art Institute many times, and it seems like every time I go there, the American Gothic, a Grant Wood picture, is always gone someplace else.
Oh.
It must be the most popular picture in the world.
I'm sorry. It is a very popular picture. It's so remarkably important in the life of Grant Wood and American art. But it's got this kind of magic. It's almost Mona Lisa magic about it, that people are drawn to it. We are very sensitive to that, and we very seldom lend it. I'm sorry that the times that you've come, it's not been here. There was a Grant Wood exhibition recently in Davenport, I think, in Iowa.
It was in his hometown in Iowa.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it seemed that it should be there for on that occasion, you know, for that exhibition, so we did do that. But we try really, really, really hard to keep that painting up, to keep the Nighthawks by Edward Hopper up. It's been away in an exhibition, but that exhibition itself, the Hopper exhibition, is coming here and opening up February 14th, so the Nighthawks will be back, and then after that exhibition is gone, it will stay here. But the Grandeshot never goes away. It once went to New York in the 1950s to the Museum of Modern Art, and a fire broke out at the Museum of Modern Art, and nothing was damaged, but it's just too important a picture to take a risk. And then there are some paintings, of course, that are not nearly iconic as those that never travel for reasons of their state of conservation, but it's true. And, you know, we do have it on our website. We do have a page that says before you come, and it tells you if important paintings, you know, popular paintings like those, aren't here, when they'll be back. So I hope that people check before they come. But I'm sorry that when you've come, it's not been here.
The thing I do find very interesting about the Art Institute is the fact that you can get so close to your pictures. Obviously, you're not allowed to touch. I understand that. But it's amazing how close you allow people to get to it.
Well, we trust people. You know, there have been reasons in Germany, for example, not to trust people. And so in all of the major museums in Germany, all of the pictures have glass on them to protect the surface of the painting. There's a certain compromise experience in that respect because light reflects off the surface of the glass and, you know, it doesn't have the same vitality. It doesn't seem to live as it does without the glass. It wasn't painted to have glass on in these pictures. So we do keep people away by having stanchions with, you know, little ropes in front of pictures and so forth, and guards in the room to be protective. But we respect our visitors, and you know, that respect has been returned. People are very respectful of our pictures.
And I must also state, for the last thing I was going to mention, the many times I've been there, your docents are just fabulous. They walk around and they'll talk to you out of the clear blue sky, and it's just fabulous. I just enjoy that a great deal.
Oh, well, you're very kind. Thank you very much.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is the president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago, James Cuno. And we have about 10 minutes left in this part of the show. We have a couple of other callers here, and others would be welcome. We'd accommodate as many as we possibly can in the time that remains. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And our next caller is here on the campus somewhere, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. You've been very fortunate to have been at some very wonderful museums, such as the Fogg Museum at Harvard and the Courtauld Gallery at the University of London, and both of those have an educational component too, as does the Art Institute of Chicago with its school. And I just wonder if you could discuss sort of the role of art museums in education, and I know a lot of school groups visit your museum, and my daughter teaches high school, and she takes a group from Central Illinois up to the Art Institute every year. It's a, you know, a major first time many kids have been to the big city. But anyway, I just wondered if you could discuss sort of the role of museums, art museums, in education.
Well, thank you. It's a, you know, a very big question. I'll try to be economical in my reply. You know, I think that education occurs on different levels and at different times in one's life. I didn't go to an art museum in my life until I was a sophomore in college, and I didn't come from a family that was a college-educated family, and nor a family that lived anywhere near art museums. My father was a career Air Force officer, and in those years we tended to live in isolated places because the military protected its assets that way. So we weren't anywhere near museums. I was closer to missile silos than museums. But when I finally did get to a museum, it literally changed my life. I mean, it was at the Louvre Museum. I was a student who was traveling, as one did in the late 60s, rather easily. And I found my way in there as a curious person might. And all of a sudden, I was in this extraordinary universe of things as diverse as the world and as old as humanity. And it just, I hadn't realized that I could be part of that world. That is, that there, it was open to me, and it provoked my curiosities as it did. If I had gone to the Louvre when I was five, I would have had a very different experience, but I would have remembered it. And I think even at five, it would have provoked me to think about it a second or third time. And your daughter, I think you said, was a teacher, and we all know that it's teachers who change lives. And I've had the good fortune of having some wonderful teachers in elementary school, high school, and certainly in college. And in the company of those teachers, their enthusiasm, their excitement, their knowledge can be contagious. And at different times, whether one's 5, 10, 14, or 20, one can be directed in a certain way. But so I think, to get back to your question, that education and art museums and the art in art museums are inflected differently at the different stages of one's life and sort of cultural and intellectual development. I spent all my time teaching in universities, and universities are very much, word-based cultures. They value the word. They value argument. And if it's not the word they value, it's numbers they value. But works of art are visual things. Words aren't made of words, and we've got to wrestle words into our relationship with these works of art. And I've always thought that was a value in two respects. One was, it was a respecting an alternative way of figuring the world, that is, on visual terms now, without language. But it also required that we put language to the experience. So it refined the way we thought and the way we articulated our response in that relationship. Obviously, the third reason that it's important is it puts us in touch with, literally, almost physically, in touch with the past and human creation over time. And it brings it alive to us in ways that reading about it alone can never. So, and it leaves an indelible imprint, I think, on most people when they come into contact with, a 5,000-year-old Chinese bronze implement. So, in any case, I hope that's some kind of answer.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just opening horizons and things like that. I like the way that you address the questions. I know my daughter teaches English, and so, she takes the students and they have to do an exercise or something there, to get them to actually look at paintings. And she was dragged as a child all over to the Louvre and London and other places like that looking at images, so she just grew up with that. But
right.
These students, hers have not. And so I liked very much, the idea that it's getting the students into the museum, just getting them in there in the first place, and then opening their eyes.
Yes, and I think there are two other things to this, and I'll presume something on your daughter's students that may not be true, but I know it to be true of many people here in Chicago. They don't feel necessarily that they have a place in what they perceive to be the institutions of power in their city, that they are from a neighborhood or from a background that leaves them alienated from these institutions they perceive as powerful, as belonging to somebody else, another part of the city, just like the rest of their lives seem to be lived alienated from those other kinds of experiences. I think by bringing those people, those kids, into the museum, to let them know that this is their museum, that we are here for them, that in and of itself, independent of the works of art they see or inspired by, is life-changing. that they're part of the life of the city.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're getting down to the point we have 3-4 minutes left, and I want to try to include at least one more person. No. You don't need to apologize, Dr. Cuno. We'd like to try to get in as many callers as we can, and we'll go next to Champagne, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, one area that hasn't been discussed is, and I know it's a big challenge, is conservation, and especially when it has to do with the collection with lead and these various environmental things. So if you'd like to spend a little time discussing this, it's got to be a huge challenge. So I'll just hang up and let you talk.
All right.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's it is a very important part of what we do, not only in the preservation aspect of preserving the things that we've been given the responsibility to care for, and as the caller suggests, indicated, they come in all kinds of materials, and these materials have all kinds of different lives to them and different hazards associated with them. So there is the preservation of these things to make sure that we pass them on from one generation to the next in good condition. The second aspect, though, is the analytical aspect. That is, the conservation includes both preservation and analysis, the technical analysis, that it helps us to understand how something was made, to better understand how it appears or why it appears as it does appear, to help us understand the history of manufacture of things, economics of manufacture, what things were made of. Also, it helps us understand the authenticity of things. That is, if something was made of materials that weren't invented when we thought this object was made, we know something's wrong. And so it's both, conservation is both preservation and analysis, and analysis is both about authenticity and attribution to a particular artist, but also about the larger scientific and historical questions of the making of these objects.
We're down to just the last couple of minutes here. I'm sorry to say there's much more I'm sure that we could discuss that we haven't gotten to, and perhaps someday in the future we could talk again. One thing I want to, though, make certain to ask you about is what I am sure is big news today in the art world, at least in the art management world, and that is the announcement that the director, the man who has been director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art for the last 30 years, Philippe de Montebello, has announced that he's going to retire at the end of the year. It's a front-page story on today's New York Times. And also in the paper, there is a list of people that would be considered to be candidates for the job, and your name is on the list. And I'm trying to think of a way that I can ask you a question that you actually can answer. Maybe I'll say, would you like to take your name off the list, or would you consider that would be something that you would be interested in thinking about?
Well, I should say that Philippe de Montebello has been the leading art museum director of our age, bar none in the world. And secondly, I would say that he's the conscience, really, of the profession in this country in terms of the standards he has set over those 30 years for that extraordinary international resource called the Metropolitan Museum of Art. To be mentioned with those other distinguished people in association with Philippe is an enormous honor. And at this point, it is simply an honor. The Art Institute of Chicago is an extraordinary museum that has all of my affection, and the city of Chicago is the greatest civic community in the country, and it has all of my affection.
Mm. When you look at all of the various challenges that you face, and that someone in your position does face, is there anything that particularly stands out, among all of the things we talked about, or anything that we haven't?
Yes, I think there is one significant challenge that we're facing today for those of us who have the responsibility of encyclopedic museums, that is, museums that comprise collections representative of all the world's cultures. The history of the Encyclopedic Museum, very briefly, beginning with the British Museum in the 18th century, was to put under one roof representative examples of the world's diverse cultures with the prospect that we would learn from them about the things that unite us rather than divide us, and that the fundamental interrelatedness of culture is a fact that we need to appreciate, and it's a fact that has been increasingly ignored with various waves of nationalism and sectarian violence in the world. And that means that we want to build these international, these encyclopedic collections in the last 50 years or so, with the rise again of nationalism after the Second World War, it's been increasingly difficult to do that because nation states have claimed these works of art, however distant in time from the present they were made, as their cultural property, as their national property, and crucial to their national self-esteem and identity. And so there is a tendency to prevent the circulation, the licit, not illicit, but the legitimate legal circulation of the world's common artistic legacy, and rather to restrict it and to keep it in the confines of particular nation states. And I think that's ultimately to our detriment, and in fact, it is a dangerous set of conditions.
Hmm.
So I think that's the biggest challenge we have today. We want our museums to be gateways to the world for the people who come and spend time with our collections, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to do that.
Our guest, James Cuno, he is the president and Eloise W. Martin Director of the Art Institute of Chicago. Dr. Cuno, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.